From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We shop, therefore we are, or so it can seem that way this time of year. What other explanation could there be for our willingness to stand in long lines at the mall or burn the midnight oil surfing online for cashmere socks? Tonight on Point, shopping as the new ritual of American self-definition. But first, a Pentagon audit has found evidence that the Halliburton Company may have overcharged the U.S. government by as much as $61 million for fuel delivered in Iraq. The Defense Contract Audit Agency has assigned 20 auditors to examine Halliburton's activities in a wide-ranging probe. President Bush said today that any overcharge will have to be repaid. Neil King has been covering Halliburton for the Wall Street Journal. He joins me now from Washington. Neil, does it look as though Halliburton's going to be on the hook for $61 million to pay back to the U.S. government?
Well, it's still a little bit midstream, so it's a little hard to say. But the preliminary findings of this audit is that that is the case. And if it's found that finally ruled in that direction, then Halliburton would have to refund that.
Neil, I want to ask what brought this to the fore in this way? A couple of months ago, we heard about high prices for fuel in Iraq. Why has it become such a big issue now?
Well, that's a good question, and there's lots of ways to answer that. But basically, the DCAA, which is this audit agency that you just mentioned, is an audit agency that essentially lives in a way with these big contractors and is, in some sense, sort of perpetually auditing them. And in doing this, they found that there was some discrepancy in this whole fuel arrangement. And their conclusion was, at least at the moment, was that actually a subcontractor that Halliburton KBR was using in Kuwait had been charging KBR too much for the fuel.
That's Kellogg Brown and Root, the subsidiary of Halliburton.
Yeah, exactly. There, so far, is not the allegation that they're making that Kellogg Brown and Root profited to the extent of $61 million, but that they were perhaps not as vigilant as they should be, and it led to this degree of an overcharge.
So does there appear to be war profiteering going on here, or simply a difference in defining what's an appropriate charge? What's it look like?
Well, what they're actually saying at the agency at the moment, at this audit agency, is their fears are that in the rush to do all of these things in Iraq at the same time, bring in fuel under difficult circumstances, feed all these troops, provision them, all these various things that Halliburton, Brown and Root is doing, that they're concerned that their own financial control systems may have failed them in various occasions. And so this audit that's ongoing at the moment goes way beyond just the fuel thing to look into all of the other aspects of the activities that Kellogg Brown and Root is ongoing at the moment in Iraq. So it's actually much larger, but it's not necessarily alleging wrongdoing at the moment.
Now, 61 million, as large a number as that is fairly small compared to the overall Halliburton contract level here. As I understand, they've got a couple of contracts, big contracts, for $2 billion each. Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually at the moment a little bit bigger than that. One of them, which is basically to provide huge logistical support to the Army, is an ongoing contract that could go well into the, you know, $6-7 billion, because it's many, many millions of dollars a day to feed the troops and that sort of thing. So it's very large numbers. The actual fuel contract at the moment, they've spent about $1.2 billion on the fuel. So I suppose even with that number, $60 million isn't big money, but in the shopping season, there are a lot of people that could use it themselves.
Democratic presidential contenders have been absolutely savaging Halliburton and the Pentagon and President Bush for the appearance of wrongdoing today. President Bush appeared with his statement today to try and defuse that. He was very ready to say, he said, if there's an overcharge, like we think there is, we expect that money to be repaid. He was prepared to step up and point a pretty tough finger already at Halliburton.
Well, the conspiracy theorists around town are already thinking that this is something that the administration kind of wanted to have come to a fore this month, at this season, and kind of air the Halliburton thing, which has been out there for a while, once and for all, clear them of wrongdoing, not necessarily in some plotting way, but because perhaps that's where the evidence points, and then kind of move on. I think in some strange ways, the president's comments this afternoon lend some credence to that very theory, that that is what they really want to do. There was a weird, you asked earlier about why now, there was a weird quality about how the Pentagon just called this press conference yesterday kind of out of the blue and aired these allegations that themselves were preliminary. I mean, this is a preliminary audit that is yet completed, which is a very strange thing to be talking in this sort of public way about an audit that's not yet done.
And the president very ready to accept it. He said, like we think there is in regard to an overcharge. So it may be that the president may be inoculating himself or trying to against more charges about Halliburton, where, of course, Vice President Dick Cheney was CEO until he joined Bush. He may want to distance himself from all that and do it now.
That's, I think inoculation is not necessarily a bad word to be using. I think that is the desire. I think there are things that can be said on Halliburton's behalf. I mean, for one, they've actually been trying desperately to get rid of this particular fuel contract or that particular job because it is there's a thankless quality about it, and there's nobody else really wanting to do it. And so far, there's no real proof that it's necessarily that profitable, despite the fact that the prices that they've been charging are quite a bit more than what even the Pentagon has been bringing similar fuel in from Kuwait. So there's still a lot that's strange about this, but I think the word inoculation is probably not a bad one.
Neil King, thanks for your insights tonight. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Neil King has been covering Halliburton for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. Scoring that elusive hokey-pokey Elmo, buying Italian leather boots on the final markdown, shopping today is so much more than just buying. It's about pleasure, truth, beauty, and perfection, says sociologist Sharon Zukin. Zukin has scoured the mega malls, strolled the open-air markets. She has loaded up her cart and listened to consumers. Her conclusion, Americans now, to a remarkable degree, find and define themselves through shopping. Tonight on Point, we're talking about the inner life of the American shopper. Does shopping define you? Beyond simple need, what leads you to shop? Do you seek fulfillment at your favorite pastoral farm stand, dignity at Brooks Brothers, democracy at Walmart? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Sharon Zukin, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and the City University Graduate Center. Her new book is Point of Purchase, How Shopping Changed American Culture. Good evening and welcome, Sharon Zukin.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. So what's the message in all the shopping, Sharon? You're saying it's more than just we know it's more than just going out and buying what we need to survive. It's a lot more than that. But you're saying that bit by bit it's become something it didn't used to be in American culture. What is that?
First of all, shopping has taken over our landscape. We've grown up as a society with an interest in trade and commerce. We've always had small shops and public markets. But sometime in the 1990s, I looked around and the stores were getting bigger than ever. There were more malls that were crowded all the time. And every issue of a newspaper or a magazine advised us about what to buy and where to get it. I don't think the explanation is affluenza, greed, the urge to splurge. I think that the economic institutions and the culture of the society had totally shifted so that we became, by the 1990s, a society that spent a lot of time researching goods, looking at goods, and imagining what goods we could surround ourselves with.
And this remarkable idea in your book that Americans now create value not by creating products or creating art, but by shopping itself. What do you mean by that?
I mean this in the sense of spiritual values and also, to some degree, economic values. Consider the alternatives. Most of us don't make our own clothes. We don't build our own houses or automobiles. We don't bake our own bread. We go out to shop for everything we need to survive, not only the material goods, but also health care, vacations, and schools for the kids. Whether we go to public school or private school, we're looking around at an array of choices as though we're in a supermarket all the time. I wasn't the first person to point this out. I think it was Randall Jarrell back in the 1950s who wrote about society becoming a supermarket of choices. And this is the way people approach the choices in life, as though they're arrayed on a supermarket shelf. And when we don't have enough choices, we feel dissatisfied. We complain in stores as in life.
And this creation of value, what's the value you're talking about then? If it's not actually making something, it's the value of carving a purchase out of that vast ocean of options, or carving a personality, a persona out of the material things that we buy? What is the creation of value there?
You've said it. You've said it. On the one hand, we're exercising our intelligence and our skills, a little bit like the old hunters and gatherers. We're finding something that is a perfect specimen. And then we're going after perfection. We're looking for the best of what we can afford. And sometimes we're looking for the best of what we can't even afford. To some degree, people have always wanted the best. But as the array of choices has grown, we've become bigger researchers. We go farther afield looking for the best. And because of the spread of consumer guides, particularly from the 1960s on, we have come to think that we have a right, an entitlement, to get the best of whatever there is to shop for.
Is that a worthy moral preoccupation, as you call it? I mean, someone carved statues from marble. Someone else buys the statue. Can that really be seen on a comparable plane of value creation?
Well, there have always been fewer producers of great values and great statues than consumers. There, you know, most of us don't have the talent to make things or to sculpt those marble statues. So there have always been more people who just observed and who bought. But it turns out that shopping can be a noble pursuit, I think, when mothers are shopping for children. When people are shopping for books or tools. And also it can be noble when people are spreading their resources to find something that will truly make themselves or their friends, their relatives, their neighbors happy.
And all that taking place in what you describe as a kind of social spaces of consumption that represent dreams and urges for social status and perfection. It's not just the objects purchased, but it's kind of the theater, the drama, the landscapes of shopping and consumption that you see as defining much of American culture.
Yes, I'm glad you picked that up. It's extremely important to think about us as being surrounded by goods, in particular theatrical settings. And the stores are very conscious of arranging the goods in a way that speaks to our inner longings. I'm not just talking about a sensuous array of cashmere socks, which you mentioned earlier, or sweaters or stripes or beautiful colors, which are all very important and which satisfy our senses when we walk into a store. But stores are very conscious of luring us into certain aspects of the American dream. You said it earlier, a store like Walmart, which offers very low prices and has attracted people of different income levels to shop in the same store or the same space, all on one level, where the goods are all transparent. They're all sitting next to each other on the shelves, the $3 bottle of olive oil next to the $20 gallon of olive oil next to the $5 gallon of corn oil, the generic next to the brand name. A space like that represents equality to Americans who have given up the social dream of equality. A branded store represents a space where shoppers go to commune with the culture, which they feel they can't grab any other way. I don't necessarily like these social spaces, but I can recognize that these are the spaces we move in.
Wow. Sharon Zuckerman, there's a lot we want to hear about, both historically and what's going on right now. It's fascinating. You say you yourself are not really a big-time shopper, but you're not just coming out to throw stones here. You're interpreting this as a sociologist. We're looking tonight at shopping as the new ritual of American self-definition. My guest is Sharon Zuckerman. She's professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and author of Point of Purchase, How Shopping Changed American Culture. Does your shopping define you? Are we what we buy? Has it come to that? Does shopping now trump religion, work, and politics in the scheme of American values? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about shopping as the new ritual of American self-definition. My guest is Sharon Zukin. She's author of the new book, Point of Purchase, How Shopping Changed American Culture. You can join the conversation. Does shopping, your shopping, define you? And beyond simple need, what motivates you to shop? Do you seek pastoral fulfillment at your favorite farm stand, dignity at Brooks Brothers, democracy at Walmart? And are you conscious of the world of consumption as the stage set of American life? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sharon Zukin, walk us through time just a little bit here and the evolution of American consumption and shopping to this point that you described. Now, how did it unfold?
The era of mass production really begins in the 1870s after the Civil War. You've got stores like F.W. Woolworth's Five and a Dime taking
the sort of Walmart of its day.
Absolutely. Taking Americans' desire for variety and novelty at low prices into a whole new forum. When he set prices at 5 cents and then eventually 10 cents and arrayed a new manufactured goods out on a counter, he satisfied a lot of people who had never had these newfangled things in their lives before. I'm not saying that these products made people's lives easier, but they made them more pleasurable. They gave them a sense that they were really moving into modern times.
And into a space of consumption, not standing at the counter at the general store asking someone to give you 2 pounds of nails, but physically walking through all these products around them.
That's right. They were literally walking through the modern age and seeing all the things that money could buy and all the things that could be brought to their doorstep for their pleasure.
Then came the big department stores, of course, and then you describe in the last, I forget how many years now, I should recall, but this quadrupling of retail space per American. What is that about? What's driving that explosion most recently?
Well, now we get into the really negative side of shopping. There are just too many stores and now websites to do a good business. And the retail industry across the board has known that there are too many stores since the 1960s for supermarkets and the 70s for all other kinds of stores. Why do companies set up stores? To sell us more goods. And there, it's really interesting. We have to stop blaming the shoppers who I think are out there looking for truth, beauty, and perfection, but we have to look at the companies that keep opening these spaces before us.
Why do they do it if there are too many already? And you say that retailers are suffering a crisis of confidence, that they don't know what to offer anymore. Why do they keep opening more and more stores?
I think they're suffering a crisis of credibility with investors also. They're trying desperately to reach the public. Look back at the 1980s, which is when the branded stores really came into existence.
The Gap and all that.
The Gap went through a huge makeover in the middle of the 80s, for example. Chairman who just retired, actually, and turned the reins over to his son, chose a new CEO who had a great deal of experience in the retail field, who came out of Bloomingdale's in New York originally, and put the Gap on the map the way we know it today by changing their visual design as well as their sources of supply and putting the Gap label on everything they sold.
But so what? Why does that matter? What's the consequence or the bigger implication?
It changed the Gap into a branded store. People now went from the mid-80s went to the Gap not because they could get cheap jeans there and a cheap T-shirt, but because the Gap offered a total look under their own name.
And you're saying this was part of this kind of definition. You could become a Gap person wherever you were in the country.
And eventually throughout the world, you could become a Gap person. You could enter into the world of the Gap. This was a kind of definition of the universe that up to that point had been dominated by the big fashion designers, the Parisian designers, for example. This was the first time that the cachet of a Christian Dior or an Yves Saint Laurent was taken down to the level of the affordable chain store. And it really had a huge effect both on the Gap and on stores across the board.
They're getting a much more dynamic environment. But when you talk about shopping, which for many people, you know, they may love it, but even if they do, it's got all kinds of negative implications. It can be very tedious, or it can just sound like rank consumerism. But you talk about it in some dimensions that I want to understand, supplanting religion, work, and politics as a source of meaning, a source of values. Illuminate that for us. It's hard to follow.
When people search for perfection today, most of them in the United States, at least, do not go to traditional churches.
An awful lot of people do. Perhaps not as many as go to malls, though.
I think more people go to malls. And there are, of course, increased publics for the more expressive churches and the fundamentalist religious forms. But organized religion for many years in the United States has weakened in terms of affiliations and weekly attendance at services.
And shopping fills the void?
Well, I wouldn't say that in terms of ideal values for everyone, but people now go to the mall on Sunday instead of going to church.
But that's just a change in temporal change in time.
Well, it's a change
and place.
In place. It's a change in place, certainly. But people are looking for a way to be with the public and a way to achieve perfection. Now, I'm not saying that shopping is as good as religion or work or politics, but I'm saying that people have altered where they look for true value. And for many people, going to a mall is their way of being in public with other people.
And looking for true value or values, not in religion, not in work, not in politics, says Sharon Zukin, but shopping. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Sharon, a lot of people want to talk to you. I'm going to invite them in. Gayatri is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Gayatri. You're on the air.
Oh, hey.
Good evening. What's on your mind?
I was agreeing to her idea about having true values. The reason being that my experience has been when you want to shop, it's been that when you're trying to do something for children, you can give away during the holidays. It sort of adds in, like, you know, it tells you, yeah, it gives you your true values. You're doing it for a good cause. And it's sort of the sense of self-contentment comes in there. And the idea of giving really makes it more and more fun, especially when you're buying gifts for children and all.
So I get it when it's a kind of gift giving. I might be able to see it, but is it really something that serves for you, Gayatri, as a substitute for religion, for valuable work, for the meaning or value in politics, for example?
It would not be a substitute, but it will enhance your instead of going and watching other things like which are not really going to be helpful for you, but if you're going to do some kind of shopping, you will also increase the economic value as such.
Right. And President Bush said, go shop, and you're ready to do it.
No. It has to be selective shopping. It's not that I'm not going to drop my hat and go for shopping all the time. If it's for some purpose, I'm going to be doing it for someone, then I would definitely go ahead and do that.
Gotcha. We've got it. You're ready to see this as a source of value, even value creation. Thanks for your call. Sharon Zukin, it's interesting. I mean, you've come into this in a kind of non-judgmental way. You're not taking, Thorstein Veblen, who was the one who savaged conspicuous consumption and set up that whole sort of tenor of negativity around shopping. You're not really doing that. You're saying there may be something positive, some kind of human creativity underway here.
Tom, I have to confess that when I started doing research on shopping a few years ago, I thought I was going to prove that everybody was into status seeking. People were suffering the malaise of the century by conspicuous consumption. But when I actually talked to people, I found that the shopping was much more sympathetic to me than I had started out thinking.
You must get a lot of grief for that sometimes. I mean, Gayatri is kind of agreeing with you here, but we know there's also a lot of guilt and angst and even revulsion around shopping, as much as people may love it at another moment.
Well, I think that shoppers have to pay attention to shopping where their business is going to do some good. That I'm very strong on. At the end of Point of Purchase, I talk about shopping the way it should be, and I talk about the farmer's market where I love to shop. I think people should shop where they can speak to the producers directly. I think people should shop in independently owned stores rather than in big chain stores. They should support local businesses.
Because it creates environments of community and conversation and interaction.
Much more community than we find in most political discussions these days, unfortunately, and much more community than people find on the street, in the cities, or in the suburbs.
Well, the marketplace has certainly, since time immemorial, been in a place for creation of a kind of community. Ed's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
Two comments I hope that you can respond to. First, I had the great pleasure of working with a bunch of emigres from the former Soviet Union back in the early 90s.
Yeah. Who
would come to the United States. And they would walk into these mega shopping malls and just look down the aisles and see 250 different kinds of bread. And some would break down into tears because the amount of choice they had in mm-hmm. terms of everyday decisions was completely overwhelming. What pair of blue jeans? They got 50 styles you can choose from.
What did you take away from that, Ed?
It's too much. There was a feeling that many folks would return to where they came from because they said, this is just too many things I have to think about on a daily basis. And they were just completely overloaded to the point where they couldn't sit, drink a cup of tea and think a grand thought because they had to worry about what kind of bed they wanted to purchase the next day.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, Ed. Thanks for your call. Sharon Zukin, how about it? Here's post-Soviet folks coming to the States and breaking down in tears at the sight of all the material glut and being overwhelmed by it. It's interesting. I mean, I've sat in Moscow and had long nights with very simple material items. This was maybe a decade ago, but great, great conversations. Are you suggesting that our lives are necessarily enhanced by all this shopping? I mean, couldn't we have much simpler material products, goods around us and have just as great or maybe greater intellectual lives, spiritual lives, social lives?
Ed has put his finger on the paradox of choice. We do have too much choice, that's fed to us, but it's not real choice. You know, we can go to a store and see 10 varieties of hair conditioner or 100 varieties of cola on the shelves, but that doesn't mean that we have a real choice between one way of life and another. So I think this is another example of overstoring where we can't blame ourselves for responding to what has become the natural environment for us almost of too much choice.
And yet you describe people trying to define themselves within that realm. It's an interesting dilemma.
People
there.
Often try to define themselves in a simple way, but when they go out to buy something, which they need, they find that their life becomes overcomplicated in a way similar to those Soviet emigres who were overwhelmed by too much choice. In Point of Purchase, I tell the story of a young woman who spent a year shopping for the perfect pair of leather pants.
Because she couldn't find leather pants?
Well, when I first start telling this story, people say, oh, my goodness, this woman is a total narcissist. Why is she shopping for leather pants? And why should she spend a year agitating herself about such a luxury item? But in fact, this is a young woman who works for a nonprofit organization. She earns a decent income. She lives modestly. But she decided she wanted a pair of leather pants. Maybe she likes the way they feel. Maybe she saw a picture in a fashion magazine. I think it's legitimate that when she needed a pair of pants, she chose to buy a pair of leather pants.
But why did it take a year? I mean, there must be mountains of leather pants around.
This is the story. She said she wanted a classic pair of leather pants. She didn't want a pair that looked too tight or too fashionable. She wanted a solid pair that would last. And she went to one store after another. She's also a very small woman, by the way, and sometimes she has difficulty finding her size. So she went to store after store to find a pair of leather pants that looked like a decent pair of pants, a classic pair of pants.
I don't know if this is inspiration or psychosis, though. A year?
Well, she just couldn't find anything because most of the leather pants she found were too expensive. In one store, a sales person was rude to her. In another store, she missed the boat and came too late. All the leather pants were gone. I don't think her desire was illegitimate. I think we're inclined to look at the other person and say that person is a status seeker or that person is a narcissist mm-hmm. because of what they're shopping
and
for.
And when she finally found that leather pair of pants that fit her dream, that perfect happiness? Did the skies open? Did the angels sing?
It was the perfect resolution. She was a woman who moved to New York City from out of town. She was used to going to suburban shopping malls. Someone in New York told her to go to the Lower East Side. And my goodness, within 5 minutes, she found the perfect pair of leather pants in a low-price store on the Lower East Side.
There you go. Melinda's calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Melinda. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, it's my business to be in the secondary market of all this consumption.
Now, what does that mean exactly, Melinda?
We own a chain of children's secondhand clothing
stores across
the country.
Yep.
Called Other Mothers, but we're surrounded by shoppers who are we've done surveys over the years. I've been doing this about 22 years, and price, quality, selection always comes up no matter how we word the survey, how many choices we give them. Price comes back as number one. And I was with this lady with the leather pants, part of it is the thrill of the hunt for many of these people. We're not dealing just with the diehard poor.
Does that make your secondhand shop more interesting because they're never quite sure what they're going to find
right,
there? The variety is more unpredictable.
People come and say, people who are very well off, and they say, I'm afraid not to come every few days because I might miss something because we can't, it's not like we can replace it. So there's a lot of the thrill of the hunt that goes on in the shopping. And, of course, there's people who our best customers are house poor. You know, their houses are over $100,000 or more. They want their kids to look nice, but they want those brand names. But they're
shopping secondhand to get it. Melinda, we've got a break coming up, but thank you very much for your call. Sharon Zukin, can you hear the hunter-gatherer instinct alive and well there?
Yes, that's around, too.
It's all happening at the shopping center, maybe at the second-hand shop. It's the shopping season. Are you feeling, listeners, defined by your shopping? Are you finding value in your shopping? Are you feeling depleted by your shopping? We're looking at shopping as the new ritual of American self-definition. My guest is Sharon Zukin. Her book is Point of Purchase. You can join us. What does the way you shop and where you shop say about you? Does Sharon Zukin overstate the defining power of shopping, or do we live in a kind of denial about it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about shopping. My guest is Sharon Zukin. Her new book is Point of Purchase, How Shopping Changed American Culture. You can join the conversation. Does your shopping define you? Deep down, are you the brands you buy? Do you want to be? And does shopping now trump religion, work, and politics in the scheme of American values? Can you picture that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steven's calling from Yuba, Wisconsin. Hi, Steven. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think the operative term, Tom, you used was revulsion. I see this this whole subject as a kind of displacement behavior, what a flock of chickens might do when they feel threatened by a by a coyote or something. We Americans have created such a monstrous money system mess that's engulfing the planet as we despoil the earth and its resources, the atmosphere and so forth. And so it's tragically and ironic and so sad that this commercialist virus has been let loose and created such a wasteland of our architecture and our highways.
Stephen, with that attitude, how do you survive in the world that Sharon Zucman describes?
I don't go out into it. I'm in a cabin in the woods. I do my best not to make any money and, of course, not to spend any. I take what I need out of the dumpsters, and I hit big corporations when I have to grab something. But I try to stay away from this terrible, soul-killing cancer that has developed this monstrous war machine. And I frankly think that the American mind is on the verge of breakdown, the way we're bringing up.
Stephen, hang on. I want to turn to Sharon Zucman for a moment. Sharon, Stephen describes this shopping as a kind of displacement behavior, and it's interesting because you do the same in a way. I mean, you say people used to make things themselves. Now they don't do that as much, but their shopping is a kind of value creation, a kind of way of carving out a life, a worldview. He's seeing it as a negative. You're not necessarily seeing it that way.
Well, I'm saying that this is all we have, most of us. This is our way to satisfy our needs, not just for material goods, but also for beauty, for pleasure. I appreciate Tom's communicating with us from that cabin in the woods in Wisconsin.
Stephen, that
I
is,
really,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I really do. But, gosh, if I went to that cabin, I guess I'd need to order my jacket from L.L. Bean and get a plaid blanket from somewhere.
Well, what's your answer to this despoiling the earth critique, the resource, exploitation critique, and fear that the culture you're describing is in some way fundamentally destructive? Are you not persuaded?
The environmental issue is a serious one, and I would like manufacturers to take responsibility for reusing the materials that they put into products. I'd like there to be a lot less trash and waste in society. I agree fully with that. I'm not a partisan of shop for retail therapy and shop to save the economy point of view. I do wish that production still made up more of a part of the American economy than consumption.
Yeah, Stephen, thanks for your call. Deb's calling from Hamilton, Massachusetts. Hi, Deb. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Evening.
Well, I can understand some of the comments that are being made about people going to the malls to experience some togetherness. I think just as there's been a rise in the number of support groups, I think people have a universal need to belong. But I personally find it empty to be in a large group of people to which I'm not connected in any way. And also inefficient. I don't have time to go from store to store. Been a year looking for something, and I prefer to shop on the internet.
So you're
much more choice, and price competition is incredible, and I've had a very good experience doing that, and I very rarely go to the mall anymore.
So forget that community. It doesn't work for you anyway. You're just as happy to sit with your keyboard and your screen. Deb, thanks for your call. Sharon Zucman, you write about internet shopping as yet another kind of tentacle of this whole world. How does it fit into the picture?
The internet has made shopping a less social and a more abstract activity. I don't like internet shopping, and I do it very rarely. That doesn't mean that the men I see around me aren't addicted to internet shopping.
And Deb, who prefers it to the crowds in the mall that she doesn't feel connected to.
Yes, but sitting at her kitchen table tapping away at various retail sites is not going to help her feel connected to people either. I think it's going to make her feel less connected to the rest of society.
But maybe she just wants to get her shopping finished there and go out and connect with people in a way that has nothing to do with buying or selling.
Ah, I think saving time by internet shopping is a myth. I think people spend a lot more time clicking away to find the best price. I know that there are various shop bots that are supposed to do comparison shopping for us, but there is as yet no bot that negotiates online with another bot to get the price down. We have to do the work ourselves. Even though we think we're saving time and money on the internet, we're spending either time or money to click away at different sites. And remember that a website is like a store. It wants to retain each shopper as long as possible. So we may think we're getting a good deal on the internet, but in fact, we're spending more time on each site. And ultimately, I think internet shoppers spend more money.
Interesting. So it may work for Deb, but you still long for that physical place, the community around it, and in your view, maybe even the better deal there. Alex is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I wanted to comment because I thought it was interesting your theme question, which is whether people identify shopping as their identity.
And yeah, this is the theme out of Sharon Zukin's book, Point of Purchase.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that when I first heard that, my identity is that I don't shop. So that's part of who I am.
And that in this culture, that would define you in a fairly singular way. How do you survive without shopping, Alex?
Well, it's not that I don't shop anywhere at all. I probably go grocery shopping as much as anybody else, and I don't have an aversion to going to some place to get what I need.
Right.
But I actually go for weeks and weeks without going into a store other than a grocery store, and I can honestly say that in the last 3 years, I've been in a Walmart once.
You know, I share a lot of that with you, Alex. And as I first read into Sharon Zukin's book, I thought, well, I'm not a participant in this. I don't define myself by shopping, don't even enjoy it that much. But then in a funny way, I began to think, well, there's that farm stand that I love to go to. I really prefer to shop and buy there. Well, okay, that's a kind of self-definition. Maybe you've just got a leaner profile, but does that mean ultimately you're less defined by it? Can we really escape it in this consumer society?
I have to say that there's a strong aesthetic appeal to go to like nice farm stands and these little country stores that you sometimes find, in more rural areas. I'm living right in the middle of one of the areas of Massachusetts that has one of everything.
Right. And you're not a communicant with that.
And I don't like those stores, so I'd have to drive quite a ways to find a store that isn't one of those kinds of stores, one of those mainstream stores.
Right. Got it. Alex, thanks for your call. Let me put it to Sharon Zukin. Here's a man living in the heartland of shopping center America, and he defines himself by avoiding it.
Well, maybe he's just a latent shopper.
I'm not so sure. He sounds like he's not going to bud anytime soon.
Well, first of all, a lot of men say they hate to shop, but it turns out that they actually love to shop, and they don't call shopping what they do. They call it research. They like to go to stores or websites and look for hardware, tools, music, either CDs or vinyl or musical instruments, or they like to look for books. And there is the occasional man who likes to look for shoes or suits, too. But they are rare, I admit. So usually men do like to look for a certain kind of good, but they never call that shopping. They call it research.
Yeah, that's different. That's entirely different.
Yeah, that's different. That's exactly. That's different. But what I heard from Ed's comment was that he would like to go to an unusual kind of store, but he doesn't get that. And indeed, most of the United States does not offer unusual kinds of stores or different kinds of goods.
It was kind of tyranny of the mainstream brands and chains.
Well, exactly. The shopping landscape is a terribly homogenous one. We think we have a lot of choice, but we've got 10 different brands of exactly the same stuff.
And we know it. Kathleen's calling from Sherman, New York. Hi, Kathleen. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Just great. Thanks.
My comment has to do with the people from Russia.
Okay.
I lived in Africa for years and came back and found myself crying in the grocery store as well, personally. Grew up in America. And I think after being back 6 years, my assessment of the shopping sort of goes along with the man in the woods. I think there's a detachment from one human being to another in this country.
You mean the fixation is on the product rather than on each other?
Yeah. There seems to be less openness to hospitality in the old sense, where people dropped in for a cup of coffee or you baked cookies for somebody new in the neighborhood. The communication between one person to another, to me, seems to have changed. Manners seem to have been displaced by pushing and shoving in stores to have an item. I have found it very disorienting coming back here.
So your African perspective leaves you longing for what in Africa that you're not finding here?
A human interaction that's sincere, that's not being displaced by what kind of car you drive or the label on your shirt. It's been a very strange return to find myself more at odds in my old home than in a place that was adopted, because there's real need. When people are coming to your door starving, you're more inclined to want to give people a loaf of bread and have them in for a cup of tea or feel useful or needed.
I'm sure you are, rather than rush out to the malls and independently buy your own cart full of stuff. Kathleen, it's a great perspective, and thanks for sharing it with us. Sharon Zukin, how about it? I mean, this really drives it home. Here we've got Kathleen saying she feels she had more social satisfaction in an environment of real scarcity, hunger level scarcity, than she has in this environment of hyperabundance. That's an irony, huh?
There has to be a middle point. I don't think Americans would advocate a drastic reduction in our standard of living, but we all mourn what seems to be the shift from a much more personal set of relations and perhaps more altruism. I'm not entirely sure of that, but at least more sociability to a much more abstract society. Shopping can't be blamed for that. Stores are certainly part of that, but we're really living on a much larger scale than societies have ever lived before.
And within that, though, you're still finding your satisfactions. You're a New Yorker, and you describe, even though you're not a big shopper, your favorite little shop with its favorite little environment, with the social interactions you have there, for you, those still create meaning. They create the texture of life.
Well, I'm very lucky to live in a big city where there still are independently owned stores out of the way spaces where you can find unusual objects just to look at. You know, I rarely go into stores unless I need to buy something specific. But I love walking on the streets. I always have loved this ever since I was a child growing up in Philadelphia. I've always loved walking on the streets, looking at people around me and looking into shop windows. For me, the bright lights of the big city are a huge attraction. And stores have historically contributed those bright lights to cities.
Sharon Zukin, we hear you looking to make the best of it, and we thank you for all your insights tonight. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Sharon Zukin, sociologist and author of Point of Purchase, How Shopping Changed American Culture. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.